Timmy's like all focused about like all his stuff. Michael's running over this.
He's making stupid jokes.
They're joking at me. I'm sitting here getting called a stingray.
Just look in the mirror. You'll see. Welcome to Raw. We got Ish the Fish. How you doing, buddy?
Good, how are you?
Good, man. It's been a while, dude.
Yeah, it has.
You're over here forever. Doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
Dude, I'm working hard.
Yeah.
And, I know you are, too.
And, well, thank you, but you're never in the city. It makes me sad.
Yeah, I'm always gone.
Yeah, yeah. We got Matt on another mic.
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
Great right now.
Well,
awesome, fantastic.
Till later, you won't be good.
Get it rolling up.
Is that what you mean? No. Oh, okay. Tim,
I'm doing good.
You got your mic back.
Yes.
Look,
Kells
doesn't
have to talk anymore.
Oh, Kells, you got demoted.
But he can't say anything because he only got a mic, so he has no rebuttal.
I think we were going to start this off with one of the things that we did the last podcast, and it was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
We had a little would you rather section and got some people's opinions just to get everybody a little loose and just have some fun. So what we got today, Tim?
All right. Would you rather lose the ability to read or lose the ability to speak?
Ish, you answer first every time.
I would definitely say lose the ability to speak. I feel like losing the ability to read is really, really important. And to be honest with you, I would rather communicate written down than verbally, because a lot of people unfortunately don't think before they speak, and I feel like I'd rather trade in, you know, verbal communication.
It's Kells every day.
he can't talk back.
So yeah, that's what I'd say.
Matt,
I like that point. I mean if you lose the ability to speak, you can still communicate through sign language.
No, you can't. What I'm trying to say is, like, people, when you have an idea that you want to either like disseminate, or you're trying to convince somebody of something, usually when it's written down, when it's in a book or an essay format, it's usually a lot more thought out, you know, fleshed out.
For
versus
sure.
When people are just talking, they just say whatever.
Tim, exactly. What you got? What you got?
I'd probably lose the ability to speak. I don't like speaking anyways, so.
You know, and I'm going to be the outlier over here. I think that there's power in speaking and being able to relay your ideas. If you look at history, you got people that are dictators, all kinds of things, being able to control mass populations, and they don't necessarily do that with just writing something. So I feel that is something that I would never want to give up.
I see that.
Yeah.
That's a good
point.
Not
that I want to take over a bunch of people or anything, but but impact and influence, I feel that's speaking's a strong suit of mine. And
I guess it matters on. I guess one is more important to influence others, or like if you want to disseminate your own ideas, versus
right.
if you want to. The other one's more important on if you want to take in good ideas.
For sure.
So
what we got next?
All right. Would you rather know the history of every object you touched, or be able to talk to animals?
Oh, I would say history of everything I touched. I like knowing that kind of stuff. As long as I do that, I like look it up on Wikipedia or something. Or like when I watch a movie, I'll look it up on Wikipedia. I love doing that. And then you like figure out what part of it is real and what part of it's not.
Yeah, IMDb app.
Yeah.
Holla at us. Sponsorships, money coming our way. What you got, Matt?
I'm going to let you take this one real quick. I'm still thinking on this. It's tough because I love animals.
What can an animal say to you? What are they going to say?
That's what I'm thinking.
What are they going to say?
What kind of talks can I have with these animals besides my own pets? Like,
there's not much.
What type of pets do you have? Because if it's a dog, they're just going to sit there and say,
cat and
squirrel.
Dog.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cat
yeah,
and
yeah.
Dog.
Exactly.
But I'm definitely talking to animals, though. I don't care if all they're saying is squirrel. I'm definitely talking to animals. I mean, because the whole history thing, I don't want to know what happened on this table.
There's just
things I don't
want to
know.
Well, hold on. Is the question what happened, like the history of the item or the object and what was done with it? Or is it like...
just the so however you want to take it, the history of the object.
I took it as like...
He took it a different... I was thinking about like, where did this come from kind of thing. He was talking about what happened on this table. I don't want to think about that.
I mean, they have black lights for that.
Tim, what you got?
My answer? I'm going to say object.
Object?
Oh, actually... yeah, because I know my dog ain't got nothing important to say to me.
Besides,
like, pet me, food, let me outside. Nothing important. Yeah.
But see, you get intellectual animals or intelligent animals, you know, monkeys, chimpanzees, gorillas, dolphins, elephants, yeah. You know.
How many times have you been around a monkey?
Dude. Well, yeah, I mean, Cincinnati Zoo is a great zoo.
So you just be hanging out at the zoo all the time?
Maybe. Maybe right,
fair enough.
Was ranked number one last year.
Think about all the animals
but
you can
have
talk
no
to walking through the
we
zoo.
Have kangaroos coming this year. It's only getting better.
Have you seen Dr. Doolittle? Look at all the conversations that get had when you can talk to animals.
That trailer looks good though.
Have you seen the new one?
I have not seen the new one with Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
Dude, that guy's awesome.
I remember the originals. Those are good.
Oh yeah, 100%. It's a totally different vibe though from the original.
Yeah, it's different. It's different.
Yeah.
Let's get into it. You're one of the smartest dudes I've ever met in my life.
Thank you.
You are, I don't even know if, maybe genius. I'm not going to talk smart because you're, thank you. By 10, you were coding stuff?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't call myself like a genius or like super smart. And that's kind of like the first thing that people say is, oh, you must be like a super freak or something like that. But I really don't think that's what it is. I think if I were to explain it, I would explain it as I'm really good at doing what, you know, our education system measures. Like if you,
I got you.
You understand what you get what I'm saying.
I completely get that.
You know,
yeah.
Like if you have, you know, a 100-yard dash runner,
mm-hmm.
and that's like the main event.
Yeah.
I'm really good at that. But there are other people that, you know, run marathons better than me. There are other people that swim better than me. And unfortunately, right now, you know, 100-yard dash is the main event, and all the other things are kind of not being looked at.
Yeah. That's a huge flaw in the education system.
Absolutely.
It really is.
Absolutely.
And we're getting more and more away from, I guess, leaving those things in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have any tech classes anymore.
Yeah.
Like home ec and wood shop and all that stuff. We're getting more to the, what is it, STEM or STEAM?
Yeah, STEM. Yeah.
And the kids aren't being able to be creative.
Yeah.
And that used to be what America thrived on, was the creativity aspect of it. Did you ever use your coding for anything? Or
did you
just learn it to use?
No. So I definitely, I mean, so what I did actually was over winter break. I found this website called codecademy.com. And I, you know, just went on there, started teaching myself, playing, like, it was basically gamified. And I just started doing that. And then eventually I turned that into making websites for like friends and family.
Right.
I had a small business where I would make websites for, you know, different like doctor's offices and you know, different little small businesses that my mm-hmm. friends were trying to start and stuff like that. So yeah, definitely. I definitely used it.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. I didn't know that if it was just one of those things that you were like, oh, I'm just going to learn coding.
Yeah.
And just call it a day.
No, it was boredom. It was boredom is where it came from. And I just, you know, pick something up.
To the audience, boredom, you know, read. Go learn something.
Absolutely.
Don't sit there and play video games when you're bored.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a time and place, you know.
Oh,
you can play video games a little bit, but don't overdo it.
Don't overdo it. That's everything.
Exactly.
Moderation is everything. You hold a record, right?
Well, yeah, technically, yes. So I'm the youngest BS graduate of UC history.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
I remember fighting cancer and coming into Lakota West freshman because you were like an office aide or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, we would just sit there and talk.
Yeah.
Because I was just trying to get out of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I remember.
You were there. I don't even know what the heck you were. What were you doing there?
So it was just that. I had a study hall, I think. And I was in study hall. They were helping me. They were making me like run notes down at classrooms and get people out of classrooms and stuff like that. And yeah,
How many classes were you taking there though?
So freshman year I took, I think, 4 classes at the high school, and then I was at UC for calculus, and it was freshman English.
Okay.
That was my first year. And then after that, I started eventually decreasing the amount of class I was taking at high school.
Yeah.
To the point where you guys probably didn't see me at all. You guys, like, I had one period. Remember, Matt?
Senior year, we would see you for like maybe 30 minutes every day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was because like I had to be there. There was things that I had to do, like for like attendance wise, and then I would run over, and yeah, it was just get things done. I was like running back and forth. My mom had to drive me and drop me off every single day. That was a little embarrassing.
Shout out moms.
Shout out moms.
I don't think any of us would be able to do anything without
absolutely
all the moms driving.
Absolutely
driving the classic minivans around. Oh, dude,
was it intimidating?
Oh, yeah.
The college classes?
Absolutely. I mean, imagine, like, there's a 13-year-old kid amongst us right now. You know, like, that's literally what it was. It was, like, us, and there was just, like, this 12-year-old
kid.
Probably
got a lot of just weird looks.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. So, everyone told me, like, after we got to kind of know each other in that first calc class, they told me, like, we thought that, because there was some, like, single moms that were trying to go get back to school and stuff. They thought that the mom was in the class and they couldn't find a babysitter, so she brought her kid with her. And then we were so surprised when you started raising your hand and stuff. And yeah, they thought that's what they thought at the beginning.
That's awesome.
So that program was through. What was that program called?
So it was called PSEOP, Post Secondary Enrollment Options Program. Now it's called College Credit Plus.
Okay.
And when I did it, it was only open to ninth graders and up. But since then, they've actually extended to seventh graders and up.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, like I said, I'm not like somebody special. I really don't believe that.
I think you're special.
Well, thank you. I think you're special too. But what I'm trying to say is, I'm not some sort of extraordinary. I think that there are seventh graders out there, you know, very bright kids in among us in our communities. That it's so good that they're now given this opportunity too. That if they want to, they can.
Yeah, I'm gonna echo you, because I think I know, like, Matt and I, we spent a lot of time in honors programs. I can only speak for him because of, I don't know about you, Tim.
No, you assumed right.
Okay. But I never heard of what you were doing. Like, it wasn't publicized to some extent, like, readily available.
Yeah.
Otherwise, my family probably would have pushed me for that as well, because it was free, right?
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. My family would have been like, well, hell, we'll drive you and drop you off every single day. If it means you're going to get free college and this and that and get a jump start.
Exactly.
So I think that it's, I don't even know if it's so much that there's a lot of, like, many smart middle schoolers or whatever, as much as it is, like, there's kids that will put in the effort. Because I think a lot of times in life, it's that effort.
Exactly.
It's showing up as half, really 80% of the battle.
Yeah, yeah.
How hard was that at that age?
You're absolutely right. And it's like, you know how you said, like, a lot of people don't know about it? Mm-hmm. It's these opportunities that, you know, young people are so resilient. And we work very hard.
Yep.
A lot of people are, you know, there's a reason why those, like, hustle pages, like Hustle Hard or Motivation Monday pages, you know, those get so many likes because that's our culture as a generation,
right?
But the problem is not with us. The problem is a lot of times people older than us or people that are kind of in charge of the system right now, for some reason, I don't know why, but they don't like making the opportunities readily available.
They want to limit us.
They want to limit us a little bit. And I don't know if that's on purpose. I don't know if that's on, like, they should work for it a little bit or what, but I really believe that, like you said, you know, a lot more people found out about it and knew about it, you know, it would be so much better.
Because there were a lot of bright people in our grade.
There's so many bright people.
And then you see some of these people go off and they're in med school and they're in law school and all this stuff. And you're like, huh. I mean, you may have, not you, but they may have had a jump start on all of that.
Yeah.
You know, and so it is what it is. I'm curious, though, did you ever feel that you missed out on the social side or the social life that goes along with being a high schooler?
I don't think so. I mean, if you're asking me, like, do I have any, like, regrets about not going to high school? Not really. I feel like I got a good amount of it just from, like, the morning periods. And I still had friends, like, you know, in college. And
yeah, bus rides.
The bus rides. Matt was, me and Matt were like bus ride buddies since like sixth grade.
Sounds a little weird.
Yeah. No, it wasn't weird. It was cool.
It is weird. That's crazy. So you were done by 17 then, right?
Yeah. So I graduated at 17. I actually graduated from high school and college at the same age. Because the whole program was, I was technically enrolled in high school while taking college credits at the same time. So the way that it worked is I graduated with you guys.
Yeah.
And when I graduated, I was basically like, some people carry over like AP credits and they get like whatever, 3 or 5 credits.
Yeah.
I carried over 102 credits. So on my freshman year, I came in with that many credits and I finished off my last year.
And all you need is 124 degrees.
Exactly. Right?
So. Well, exactly. And the crazy thing is those AP courses that you referenced are so much harder than college courses.
Exactly.
They are. I was told by a teacher, actually, because I was considering, oh, I'll just take as many AP courses. He looked at me and said, just graduate.
Yeah.
He was like, and then go take college courses. He was like, because you're going to spend so much more time on those AP courses than you would ever spend in one college course.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't believe him initially, and then I, you know.
Absolutely. There's a lot of things that I don't know why, but, you know, things are being made harder for us than they should be.
Yeah.
And the only people that are going to be able to change that is us.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not, for some reason, that's the way that the system is right now. And if we want to change it for our kids or our younger brothers or sisters, it's us that we have to do something about it.
For sure. And I completely am with that. With you stating that, let's bounce around a little bit.
Yeah.
You guys, well, for what the country stands for, that American dream, you know, your family came over here from Turkey.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Why did you guys leave?
So this is actually, it was probably a good question for my dad. We should get him on here. But
hey, we record 4 times a week.
Except anyone in that.
Literally.
But basically, so I guess I'll tell you guys a little bit about like Turkish history back around that, like around 2001. Edumacate. So around 2001, there was a big economic crisis in Turkey, and my father was a dentist there, and he realized that he just, you know, started a young family. He realized that in order to best provide for his family, the best opportunities, he would have to, you know, look elsewhere, and you know, he wanted to come to America, so he applied for a green card, and I don't know if you guys know this, but the green card is basically a lottery. So the chances of you getting it is just like they literally, you know, it's like playing the lottery.
Pretty much random draw.
It's random draw.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So, you know, he didn't even think that he would get it. He applied and then it landed on him and he was like, let's do this. And he left. He was a dentist in Turkey, which is a good job, stable job. But he realized that, you know, in order for, you know, his kids, his kids' education, his family's, you know, well-being, quality of life, that he was going to have to, you know, make some sacrifices. And he borrowed $700 from his friend. Not a lick of English. Maybe like a little bit, like, hello, how are you?
Yeah.
And he came and he landed in Chicago. And now he's one of the most distinguished dentists in the U.S. with like implants and stuff. And I'm very, very proud of my father. But yeah, it's... there's so much sacrifice that goes in, and that idea of the American dream is definitely still alive today. And it's just, it makes me so proud, not only of myself, but everyone else that I see, you know, chasing that.
Yeah. And that's awesome to hear you say that, because I think at least what I was preached to in college and what you see on the media is the idea of this dream is dead.
I don't think so.
And I think with you that it's very much alive. The way that you go about it may have to be a little different today.
Yeah.
But it's very much alive.
Yeah.
Did your whole family come over here?
So my immediate family did.
Okay.
But not like grandparents, uncles, they're all still back there.
Okay.
Yeah, back in Turkey.
How hard was that? Your dad would be the better person to ask, but how hard was that to leave family?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, imagine like how much of a support system that is. Right. I mean, I like you guys go to like Thanksgiving and you have the whole family over, right? Like we don't have that. And it's just like, it would usually just be me and you know, It's not that they weren't enough. My family, I love my family.
Yeah.
But it's you don't have that kind of like support system. You don't have that kind of like, you're alone basically, mm-hmm. and you only have, you know, your brother and your sister and your parents, and that's pretty much it. And if you miss your grandparents or your uncle or whatever, it's not like you can take a road trip. It's a 14-16 hour flight, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sometimes more with travel times and layovers or whatever. So it's a huge kind of like developmentally as a kid. You start to kind of, I guess it increases your bond with your immediate family members, but you're definitely a lot more lonely.
Yeah, and I think that's something we all take for granted sometimes.
Yes, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, is just the fact that, I mean, for instance, we're all good friends here, and I can drive to your house, and your house.
Exactly.
And it's like, okay, there's a support system. Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But to not be able to do that.
Absolutely.
Fly 16, yeah, I couldn't even imagine.
And for my parents, it was even harder. My dad still struggles with this to this day. Is, I mean, imagine like we're friends from what, sixth grade,
yep.
right? Imagine my dad had friends from, same thing, right? Mm-hmm. From sixth grade, and he had to leave all of those people. How, like, let's say in the future, how are we going to replace each other, right? Mm-hmm. We share memories from the basketball court at recess, you know
yep.
what I'm saying?
Yep.
And it's like, imagine this guy leaving. Yeah, he's going to make new friends here. But, you know, how strong is that bond going to be? How much of the... It's hard to replace those kinds of people. You know what I'm saying?
History is hard to...
Exactly.
You can't compete with that.
Exactly,
you know?
Those memories.
Those brotherhood bonds that
exactly.
you end up forming. And yeah, for sure. Through his experience, are you growing up, what did you... witness, I guess, as your dad pursued this American dream?
I think so, and this is kind of a lesson that I've been reminded throughout my whole life, and it's the simple idea to have this healthy disregard for the impossible. And once you start catching on to this, everything else that you thought was impossible starts breaking down. So like when, for example, he'll tell me this. He'll tell me these kinds of stories all the time. Like, my grandmother was against him going. All of his friends were against him going. Like, are you crazy? What are you doing? You have a office, a dental office here.
Right.
You have good clientele. Like, you're gonna be fine. Like, what? Why are you going? And it's impossible. You know, it's impossible for you to go over there and rebuild your whole life. But you know, having a disregard, a healthy disregard for what a lot of people say is impossible, is really, really important. That's what I saw from him. And then eventually throughout my whole life, I've seen that again and again and again.
Yeah.
And once you start to like, when somebody tells you that something's impossible and then you do it anyway, not only do you feel good, oh, all right, great, I did what everyone else thought I was impossible, but you also realize that, hey, wait a second. I thought that was impossible, but I just did it, right? So now you start to reconsider everything else that you thought was impossible before. Was I having the same fallacy as what I just did? Right? Because
yep.
now you go back, like, maybe the other thing that I thought was impossible isn't impossible. And you just, it's invigorating to think like that.
It makes you hungry.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes you hungry.
Exactly. And doesn't the word itself say I'm possible?
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I mean,
there you go.
You want to say impossible.
There you go.
Impossible. I mean, that's, I guess,
yeah,
half empty or half full.
Exactly.
Did you guys ever experience, or did your dad, did you growing up ever experience it? Like, any discrimination?
I mean, yeah, but it was never like a never made me like, I don't know, hate everyone or it was more positive than negative.
Okay.
You know, especially after 9/11, and this is as a Turkish American that was raised Muslim, you know, after 9/11, obviously there was some, you
know,
there was some tension, right? And I don't think anybody could, you know, really escape that. And I don't blame anybody for feeling that way either, because I get it, right? Mm-hmm. And the same thing is happening in Turkey right now. And I get that side of it as well. There's terrorist attacks in Turkey right now,
mm-hmm.
where it's from either Kurdish militias or, you know, Syrian-backed militias. And now there's this kind of like this hatred towards, and this kind of this discrimination against all of them. And it's a natural human instinct to be afraid.
Yeah.
So I don't blame anybody that, you know, was afraid and kind of like a little distanced, but for the most part, I would say we do have as a country, we do welcome people that are, you know, that want to come and looking for better opportunities and the things that we enjoy here,
which is really good to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because again, the media paints these pictures of hatred.
Yeah.
And negativity.
Yeah.
And even being a citizen or somebody that's been like homegrown, I guess you could say, right? You almost sometimes believe it.
Yeah.
And never being in your shoes, I would never experience coming here and being like, does everybody hate me or not? Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So to hear that is kind of, I guess, a relief.
Yeah.
Because
I mean,
proud of who we are.
I would say so. I'm proud of the way that we... I know that, you know, obviously with the latest stuff, obviously there is a little bit maybe more tension.
Right.
But I think that, you know, in our hearts, I think everyone loves, you know, seeing new people chasing their dreams.
Yeah.
So I don't have any doubt about that.
And doing it the right way too. I mean, your family did the green card experience and y'all went about it the legal way, right?
Right, right.
You know, and that's a whole sidebar conversation that could go on forever and ever about illegal people or people coming here illegally.
Yeah.
But the right way, it's, you have to admire that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about, you know, having those channels for the people that need them.
Yeah.
There are definitely, you know, needs for people that outside of our borders, there are some bad conditions, right? Mm-hmm. And there are some people that can't, you know, sign up for a lottery and wait to see if it comes.
Yep.
I don't know if the right choice is hopping the fence and coming over. But what I'm trying to say is a lot of times those people are in either life or death situations.
Yep.
They gotta run. Mm-hmm. Or even the refugees that we're seeing from Syria, refugees, even like not just in America and Europe, a lot of Syrian refugees are coming to Turkey.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
And so these people, even in Turkey, there's this, you know, why are these people coming? Don't they have their own country? A lot of these people aren't coming over to come sightsee, you know?
Right, right.
These people are coming over because they're hungry, mm-hmm. right? They can't get by. And so I think we need to have the proper channels in every circumstance for people that need it and maybe be a little bit more responsive.
And I wrote my senior, it's kind of funny. So as a senior in high school, I was in like economics and government, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I proposed that we build a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Hear me out. All right. I propose that.
Did you write a letter to Trump?
Is that where the idea stemmed from?
Yeah, maybe. From me. Yeah. Yeah. So I propose that we build a wall, not just on the Mexican border, but on the Canadian border as well. I know that would cost money and money, money, money. And
yeah.
It's not realistic. But with this wall, I wanted things like Angel Island and Ellis Island and all that stuff. Basically, like all these big immigration centers
mm-hmm.
that people like you're talking about can go there and just like a lot of our ancestors did, wait to be cleared to get into the country, and it gave you the means to apply and you know, like, because there would be bedding and it may not be the best, like it may not be a hotel where you have your own room with all this whatever, but it would be a shelter.
Yeah.
And you'd have food, doctors, all, you know, rest. Everything on hand. You can rest if you're fleeing something like cartels and danger and all
right,
this other
right.
stuff. I don't feel like there's enough of that. So therefore you have these things that
exactly.
happen. Because I don't think a wall is a negative. I see a wall as a filter mm-hmm. opposed to a barrier. And that's, I guess, where my proposal was. And actually the class really liked that idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's just making that happen. You know, you would have to have different infrastructure.
Yeah.
But I'm so for people trying to better themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what ultimately, ever since we're all born, that's all we want to do
yeah.
is we grew up with the American dream, and I can speak for myself, but it's always been, what's your family? And, you know, that's their level, but they want to push you to be another level.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's gone on for generation after generation.
Absolutely.
After generation.
Absolutely.
And it will continue.
Yeah.
But I do think that what you said is we need to be more, I don't know if responsive is the right thing, but maybe proactive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because responsive, well, that means we're consistently, in my opinion, consistently responding to oh, we let in too many of this or this or that. I think that we need plans of action.
I can see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see what you're saying.
Let's get back to your education, though. And I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but you ended up getting your master's degree in health administration, right?
So it's I got my MBA, master's in business administration, but it was specialized in healthcare administration.
Okay.
And you know, I had a certificate in leadership and management.
Okay.
So
what did you end up doing with that?
So after I graduated, I started working at UC Health, or right towards the end of it, I started working at UC Health. Actually, Easton was with me there, so we did consulting. We had a small project that was part of our MBA, and then so we did that, very successful. And afterwards, my father has a dental office here, and he had a small dental office that, you know, was just him and maybe six other people, I think. And after that was done, I had a couple other jobs lined up, but he said, "Would you like to come on board and see what we can do here?" And so I said, "Why not?" Came on board, and everything that, you know, that I was basically doing before, I started to apply at his practice. And since then, I've been able to grow it to, we are working on our third location right now, so that's under construction. And we have five doctors, and in the last since I've been on board, we've seen I think last time I checked 18,000 patients.
That's awesome.
So yeah, we're growing pretty fast, and the reason why, what I can attribute our success to, is we've been doing so much, and I've been kind of, I take to heart making sure that healthcare is transparent, making sure that it's accessible to as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it really needs to be something that people can make a choice about, instead of going to the hospital and then getting a bill.
Yeah.
You know, a week later for 10 grand. Like, for example, I'll give you one example. Right now in hospital, since the beginning of 2019, all hospitals have to post a count or a list of prices for all their medical codes, right? Now, it's a step in the right direction, but a lot of times it looks like gibberish, or it's just a list of all these different codes that you don't know which one applies to you and which one doesn't. But I guess you could kind of get a sense of if one hospital's generally lower than another one. What we do, and I did this before, I pushed for this before, you know, this law went in 2019 for hospitals. We post all of our prices online, and we're a dental office.
I don't know why more don't do that.
No, to my knowledge, I don't think there's a single dental office in the country that does that.
And
to my
I'm
knowledge.
I'm not just talking dental. I'm talking everything.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're getting a service,
yeah,
you should be able to know how much you're being charged. Like, it shouldn't be a... There was somebody that was talking to me, and they were like, not about health. It was like marketing or something.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, it was probably that guy, Matt, that we're not going to name drop. But you remember that guy?
Sure.
No. You know who I'm talking about. We had that meeting or that conference call. Yeah.
Exactly.
But it's like, oh no, I can't tell you any prices, and I can't, like,
this isn't a car dealership.
Right.
You know, this is you're getting a service.
Yes.
And you deserve to know, you know, what you're going to pay for.
I'm a real estate agent.
There you go.
Exactly. It's a service to sell your house.
Yeah.
I can tell you this is the range.
Yeah.
At least you have an idea.
Exactly.
And I don't see why people can't do that more readily.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of, it almost feels like you're being tricked.
Bait and switch.
Yeah,
exactly.
All the time.
Oh, yeah. Like the biggest thing of most, you know, healthcare, unfortunately, and this is something that I'm very passionate about, but unfortunately, healthcare in this country has been provider focused and hospital focused for way too long.
Sure.
And when it really should be patient focused, mm-hmm. right? It should be patient centric, revolving around the patient. Right now, it's around the doctor's schedule. There's how many dental offices do you know that close early on Thursdays and they're closed Friday, Saturday?
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? And it's like they're Monday. 8 to 5, 8 to 4:30, and that's it.
Great hours,
fantastic hours. But that's not when dental emergencies happen. That's not when you can go to the dentist.
Well, let's be honest. They force everybody else to call off to
exactly.
get there. It's like you have to make them a priority.
Yeah.
in turn because it's your health and you're this and you're that. But I'm paying you, so shouldn't you be there in the, like, shouldn't the hours, I'm with you, shouldn't they be, like, shifted back?
Absolutely.
You know, opposed to the more, like, shouldn't it be like, oh, we're here from noon to 8 or noon to, or 1 to 9,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And therefore, people after work, you know, you're not losing as much work. Maybe you only have to take a half day. Well, you know, whatever the case may be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we do our best to try and work with people, right? When my father first opened the practice, he was 7 days a week. And the philosophy kind of comes from him. He was open 7 days a week just because he believed in, you know, servant leadership, serving his community so much.
Amen.
And, you know, he was like, I don't care if it's a Sunday. There are patients that are going to need me. Mm-hmm. And every single Sunday, there was 3 or 4 emergency patients that needed, you know, swollen lips and swollen gums that, you know, needed him there. And they were so glad that he was there.
Yeah.
And so we always try and do, you know, extended hours in the afternoon. We're open till 6 every single day. We're open a full day on Saturday. We have, you know, anything that you need. It's kind of a one-stop shop.
That's what's up.
And it's just like, it's completely about changing this focus of healthcare back onto the patient.
You know, I'm in the market for a dentist.
Well, come on down.
What's the place called?
It's King's Dental.
King's Dental.
Yeah.
Everybody go check them out.
Yeah, King's Dental.
What was the probably the most useful thing that you've learned from your degrees and up to this point in your life?
So I would say that there's two questions there, and I'll answer them both. From my degrees, from my undergrad, I think the most important part of – I did my undergrad in biochemistry, and the most important thing that taught me was, you know, how to approach things analytically, how to solve problems in a systematic way. I mean, everyone – scoffs at the idea of the scientific method, you know, that we learn in sixth grade, right? It's like you formulate a question and then you formulate a hypothesis, you develop a test. The thing is, a lot of people think that you can only use that in a lab with beakers and you know, solvents and solutes, you know. That's not what it's limited to. You can actually use that with everything in your life. Mm-hmm. And I actually find myself using that. I didn't realize it at first. I find myself using that with everything. If I'm going to be doing something, I'll first, you know, in my head, I won't necessarily write it all down, but in my head, I'll think, you know, what's the problem? What do I think's going to happen? How can I test, you know, what I think's going to happen?
Sure.
And then I'll try it out. And then you go back to the first step, just like in science and in labs everywhere. And when they're doing research, they do the same thing. They go, okay, so now that we know that this doesn't work, what can I change? What variable can I change, right? The independent variable.
Right.
Can I change to fix this? And then so you keep going, and I'll spoil this for you. I learned later in my master's and my MBA, this is called Six Sigma. Some people may have heard it, but it's basically, you know, the Japanese figured this out with Toyota, and they basically thought, why aren't we using these same methods in our companies and the way that we're operating, not only our companies, and then they took that to healthcare. And now there's life coaches and stuff. They're preaching the same thing. You don't got to pay them money. I'm telling you right now, you can use the same thing. You know, it's just it's the same thing that they taught you in fourth grade. You know, you can apply
everything.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's kind of what we've realized too with a lot of our meetings. I mean, we start with what do we want to do?
Exactly.
And then you break it down. You know, I mean, we got some big stuff coming up and figuring out.
Yeah.
What is this? Is this going to work to reach the populace or not? That's really the biggest question.
Yeah.
I think with any business.
Yeah.
That's what's up. And I know you were going to try to do politics here in Cincinnati, right?
Absolutely. So like I said, it's, and I think you're like this too, Cody. We're people as our generation's like this. We feel a responsibility to, you know, better not just ourselves, but us together and the rest of our community.
Yep.
And so, especially with, you know, 2016, the election of 2016, I realized that, and I think a lot of people realize that, if I wait for somebody else to make these decisions for me, I'm not going to be happy, right? And I can't complain if I'm not involved. So my biggest thing was, you know, if I want to see something happen, the Messiah is not going to come and nope. fix it for me, right? We have to do something about whatever we want to change. Whatever side of the political spectrum you're on, it's always good to get involved, because if you're not participating, you're leaving the decision, your future's decision, to in the hands of somebody else. And so I actually last summer started canvassing a little bit, because I was gonna put in, you know, I was gonna seriously considering running for state office.
Yeah.
I was thinking about running for state representative, but I realized later that it's a little too premature. But you know, the mentality is still, I want to do whatever I can to improve my community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's like, and I think that's something that a lot of, you know, people that our generation that's trying to go from being a kid to adult, we're still sometimes stuck in the idea of like, if your car breaks down, hey, I'll call my dad, and dad, how do I fix my car? You know, or like, mom, can you do my laundry? We need to kind of get in, kind of flip the switch and kind of do things ourselves a little bit, because there's, you know, you can't rely on that forever. And so you have to kind of make sure that the change that you want to see is you're an active part of it.
YouTube does a lot.
That too. And that's the other thing. And I think our generation is in such a unique position.
Right.
We're the first generation to be able to do this, that everything, all the information on how to do whatever you want to do is on YouTube or on the internet. And
it really is.
I mean, you guys started a podcast, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's, I'm sure, Timmy, did you learn some things from YouTube?
I went to YouTube and typed in best equipment to buy for podcasts.
Like, there you go.
I went to YouTube and just watched people on podcasts figure out what the hell to do.
Exactly.
Because I didn't know what I was doing.
Exactly.
So.
That's exactly how I started the Book Heroes. That's exactly how I, you know, it's all about you go on there and whatever you want to do, you look up what other people are doing and how they do it and try to get ideas.
Look, I think one thing I learned in life, and that's through real estate and everything else, is don't reinvent the wheel.
Absolutely.
It's not cheating. It's not stealing. You look through history, you could have the best motivational speaker. Well, he took some stuff from the guy before him.
Yeah.
And then you could have the best Fortune 500 company. Well, they took some stuff from the company before them.
Absolutely.
It's life.
I completely agree with you. The way that I phrase it is, you don't have to be an innovator.
Right.
You don't have to be Christopher Columbus. You don't have to be Elon Musk to be successful. All you have to do is figure out what, you know, take a look around you, see what, you know, could be better. And 9 times out of 10, in fact, 99 times out of 100, there's somebody that's already thought about what you're thinking about, found a pretty good solution to it. And maybe you can take that and add your own spin to it and make it even better. And then if you do, I urge you to post that on the internet too.
Right.
So that the next person that has the same idea, they can learn from you.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of interesting you say that, because you've carried that principle over into Turkey.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to me about, because us here in America, I mean, there's some listeners that may know about Turkey, but you're going to need to educate me on the political landscape and what you guys are actually doing.
Yeah. So a lot of the issues or a lot of the problems that maybe we face here, where there's some divisiveness and, you know, there's, what do we do about, you know, immigrants, or what do we do about this or that? A lot of those issues, the economic issues that we're facing, joblessness or whatever it may be, university education, inflation, all these kinds of things, it's actually not our problem. Like, it's not a problem limited to us. Europe is having the same problems. England is having the same problems. You guys all know about Brexit, right? Mm-hmm. And even further, Turkey's having the same problems. And these are, in my opinion, these are all kind of symptoms of the same kind of problem. And it's not really a problem. It's just the fact that we as humans are going into a whole new era where technology is a much bigger part of our lives. Automation is a much bigger part of our lives. Right. And so that's changing our economy. That's changing our, you know, the way that we're living. And so with that being said, in Turkey, you know, a lot of the things that we sometimes take for granted here, that these ideas that, you know, our founding fathers put into Constitution of free speech, free press,
yep.
freedom of religion, right? A lot of those things we take for granted. Some of those things are absent in Turkey. And I wouldn't say that I'm a politician per se. My goal there is to be an advocate and just kind of push for and advocate for all those kind of democratic ideals that was one of the reasons that we came to America.
Sure.
Right? We came to America for those things.
Yeah.
My mom wears a hijab. And back then in Turkey, she was being, you know, harassed because of it, even though it's a Muslim country.
Yeah.
There are certain, you know, institutions there that, you know, didn't like that. Right. And so she would have a hard time because of it when she was in university and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's still some discrimination. There was still some discrimination that goes on, that went on. And there is still some now, too. And so we left, they left the country in search of exactly that. And so, you know, what I'm trying to do is be an advocate for that back there. And it's not about, you know, doing this for Turkey or for America. Advancing democracy in anywhere is an advancement for democracy everywhere, right? If you know, one group of people get more rights, that's a victory for everyone. Taiwan just won their election, right? Record numbers against China, distancing themselves from China again. And that's a victory for not just Taiwanese people. That's a victory for everyone,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if they have strong rights and if they're a free people, that's an ally to us and to all of humanity. So, you know, we're strong together. And if the more that we divide ourselves between party lines or country lines and borders, the more that we're going to become
yeah.
weaker as a human race.
So as you made this political party, I guess I have two questions. One, what is the government now? Is it a strict dictatorship or do they have elections like, say, Russia?
So I'll clarify. I didn't necessarily make the party. So to give you some history, there, the current people in charge, the current political party in power, the current president, he used to have a prime minister, and his party, I guess, is very mad at him because he's kind of strayed off of what he set out to do. He actually, at the very beginning, set off with the same kind of ideas, saying, you know, we shouldn't discriminate against people that are wearing a hijab. Like, mm-hmm. like I said, people should be able to practice their religion and all these kinds of things. But he's kind of strayed off of that. And so there's a lot of people that have kind of defected from the party or resigned from the party, not defected, resigned from the party. And one of those is the former prime minister. And he's a very educated man, very smart man. And he started or spearheaded a new political party. And he asked me to be on the founding board. So the founding board is about 150 people. And I was on that founding board.
It's a huge board.
It is. Well, it's a huge country.
I mean, right.
So,
right.
But yeah, so I was on the founding board, and yeah, so I got to meet him, and we work. You know, the whole board works very, very closely, and you know, the whole thing is we're pushing for a much more inclusive Turkey and give back people the rights that they deserve, right? The inalienable rights that
yeah.
we here take for granted.
Right.
As for your question on, you know, the current political system there, technically it is in on paper, it's a republic.
Okay.
And so there, it's kind of, I guess, similar to more European governments where there's, you know, ministers and then there's the prime minister. Members of parliament, I mean, sorry. And then there's a prime minister mm-hmm. and there was. And then what Erdogan did, the current president, he used to be the prime minister and he basically rewrote the constitution. I mean, I know that sounds crazy to us, but he basically rewrote the constitution, said there's not going to be a prime minister anymore. I'm going to combine that prime minister and the president position. I'm going to make myself president. And he did it. And he did it. I'm using quotes here, air quotes, through an election, which in my opinion, and many people's opinion, people were not very well informed, and you know, it was just kind of like a huge power grab, and it's just been these kinds of series of power grabs.
And because he does that, he has a chance to serve longer, correct?
Exactly. Well, there's no limit. Exactly. Yeah. There's no limit. He's been in power currently for either as prime minister or president for almost 20 years. And so, you know, eventually you're like, is there nobody else?
Yeah.
You know, with any better idea, are we really down to him?
Right.
You know?
Right. You say that I feel like we can translate a lot of this to the current political system here in America.
Mm-hmm.
Because from the Republicans and Democrats, in my opinion, we have two dated parties.
Absolutely.
That don't represent the populace, neither side.
Mm-hmm.
That we should never have an election where we are voting the lesser of two evils.
Absolutely.
That should not be the term from any voter.
Yeah.
How did y'all go about creating a political party? And do you think that that tactic can be mirrored here in America?
And that's exactly my goal. It is to be able to, you know, do it and be an example. The way that we are hoping to go about it is to give more people a voice. The fact of 2016, the tragedy of 2016, when like you said, lesser of two evils, was that not enough people were given a voice. And unfortunately, people that had no business being on that stage on both sides were paraded around.
Right.
Simply because, you know, there were people, unfortunately, at the top pulling strings that we don't even know about. Right.
We'll never know about.
You know what I'm saying? And like the fact that, you know, everyone knows about how Bernie got, lost out on the.
I don't know how that didn't burn out. Like, I'm not a Bernie fan, and I'll be the first to say
that.
I'm
not either.
But I don't understand how that information surfaces and it doesn't burn the whole party down.
It doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make any sense.
And it's like, and I know for a fact that that's not just, we found out about that one, right? I'm sure it happens on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
That we don't even find out about. The whole system is totally broken.
I like to say that the real powers are the heads of the parties.
Yeah.
In my honest opinion, because I think it's
deeper than that. I mean, I'm going to sound like some sort of conspiracy theorist, but I mean, George Carlin, one of my favorite thinkers of all time, says this country has been bought and sold a very long time ago. And I really believe so. And like I said, this whole thing there's only one way to change that, and there's only one group of people that can change that. And that's us. That's our generation. Because, you know, if we leave it to older people that have ties and the current system, it's not going to work.
No, I mean, the system needs a lot of revision.
Absolutely.
And not so much the framework, but just...
No, not the framework.
But just how we go about things.
Yeah, we need to adapt it to...
Yeah. Two parties, they fight against each other, but they should be working together.
Right, yeah. They should be. And you know,
and it's always arguments.
Congress has a horrible approval rating. I don't know how you maintain an approval rating that low and continue to just chit. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. But back to Turkey, what do you do as an advocate over there?
So, exactly that. I'm advocating for, you know, just saying that this is not normal, right?
How does that work?
Like, so,
yeah,
I'm right now. I'm trying to give as many speeches and talks and. Okay. Just trying to rally people as much as we can, because it gets to a point where, and I think that a lot of, I feel like it, even in, you know, in the United States, one of the reasons why I wanted to get into local politics here, after some time, this kind of stuff starts to feel normal, right? I mean, Trump going on air and saying the crazy stuff that he says is a little depressing. And after some time, at first it's a little shock. And then you start to get like
people become conditioned to it.
Exactly. And it starts to just kind of, you know, you just kind of sink into this hole and you start to lose hope. And so that same thing has been happening in Turkey as well. What I'm trying to do there is give people hope and say like, hey, I know it feels like we should, you know, roll under our beds and you know, roll up with a blanket and just sleep and go to bed and not think about any of this, but if we don't change this, nobody's going to.
Yep.
And so that was the reason why I felt a responsibility to try and get into local politics here. And that's the same reason why I you know, wanted to advocate over there as well.
Well, that same responsibility I've often talked about with my own family and friends. I mean, I've mentioned running for president to y'all before, and
Absolutely. They
shake their head, but I do feel so passionate about what the country can be and the people of this country.
Absolutely.
That in order to actually get our point across, as you've stated, you have to be the change.
Exactly.
And so I'm just going to throw out, you start a political party, let's talk about views, and we can see how we can go about that. But carrying over your humanitarian mindset and your ideals, you mentioned your nonprofit. What is it and what do you do?
So a couple years back now, my sister and I started a nonprofit called The Book Heroes. And basically what we do is we set up book swaps throughout Cincinnati. And we go into elementary schools and we provide kids a library of handpicked books that, and sometimes when we're picking them out, like I want to sit down and read them because they literally look so fun, even though they're like third grade reading level. But like they're like colorful and you know, they make you want to read. And the reason for it is because reading and literacy levels in kids ages from kindergarten to third grade has been found to correlate strongly to not only how they're going to do in middle school and high school, but also to graduation rate and even worse to incarceration rate.
Okay.
There are certain studies that can predict and like some private prisons right now that use studies of the literacy rate in third grade of the area. And based on that, they figure out how much like if they need to expand their prison by 15 years in 15
that's
years,
crazy.
You know what I'm saying? Because they say, okay, so literacy is low. They're expecting a higher incarcerated population.
Wow.
It's called the Matthew effect. And this actually, it comes from the Bible, the book of Matthew, where there's a verse in there. I'm going to butcher it, but it says, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Mm-hmm. It's exactly that. If you start off with a poor habit of reading or poor literacy rate, reading comprehension, then as you get along, right around third or fourth grade, you start switching from learning to read to reading to learn. And so that's your tool for everything that you're taking in. So if you have a weak, you know, reading comprehension, then it's going to mess up your whole life.
Yep.
And so they to take it even one step deeper, they looked at, you know, how can we fix this? And it turns out the secret to giving kids a love of reading is to give them access to more books that they find interesting. You can't force anybody to read. They have to want to read. And for them to want to read, they want to read books that they like or things that interest them. And so some of the schools that we're going into, you know, their libraries are very small, or maybe they don't even have access to a library or a librarian.
Yeah.
And we're able to go in and give them a pretty good wide selection of books. There's even studies that correlate with how big a student's library is and how many books they have with how their grade point average is and their SAT scores later down the line compared to, you know, nationally.
Yeah.
It's crazy how much reading is tied into not only our development, but our the rest of our lives.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
Yeah.
I know you guys have done a lot of work. And
thank you.
I tell everybody, read. Just read.
Absolutely.
I mean, some people it's hard, but it's the easiest way to get information, and it's for you to think on your own.
Yeah.
It helps build your brain and mold you. I remember whenever I was younger, and we were, I was always challenged. Like my dad, he always pushed me to read crazy stuff, and reading things like, there's one book in particular that stuck with me my whole life. It's called Swimming to Antarctica.
Huh.
And the whole thing is about this girl. It's true. It's a biography. And she just does these crazy swimming feats.
Huh.
And the one thing, I'm third grade reading this, and it's not a third grade book. And and I'm getting there, and I'm like, wow. And the one feat that stuck in my mind that just fascinates me to this day is swimming the English Channel.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I don't know if in the feat department, if that's going to come in 10 years or not, but we gonna sit there and hear it was brought up, but
this is where that inspiration derived from.
Oh gosh, yes.
Healthy disregard for the impossible.
Right. I'm not a believer in can't, and
absolutely.
And I believe that if I sit there and put my mind to whatever craft I'm going to do,
yeah,
we will succeed.
Absolutely.
And what has it meant, though? I mean, I run a nonprofit, and I've seen some small. We're younger than you, and we've been able to help our first family, yeah, which is crazy. But what has it meant to you to see all these kids always switching books and yeah, reading, and all of that success that has stemmed from directly what you've done, yeah, but also partners and help?
Yeah, and I just want to say I'm a big fan of yours as well, as far as the work that you're doing, and you know, obviously, but. No, it's huge, and it's like it's the most rewarding thing ever, being able to, you know, make a difference in someone else's life.
Yeah,
especially when it's a kid, right? And it's like what maybe you wanted someone else to do for you as a mm-hmm. kid. If you're able to do that, I think that's so big. And obviously, without, you know, the support from the rest of the community and our mentors and our teachers and
right.
The first school that took us in, Terrace Park Elementary.
Oh, you got the rich school.
Yeah. they are much more well off as a school district, but still, even there, we were able to make an impact.
Just,
you know, people coming in that care just about that, and they want to spread that.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah,
so
and that is exactly why I wanted you to get involved with the YMCA.
Yeah,
because that ties into so many different school districts around Northern Kentucky.
Yeah, Matt actually got us into YMCA.
And when I was at some of their after school programs, they didn't have many books to do.
Yeah,
to read, to go through, and then when you came through, I know that first day. I mean, kids get excited to hear about that, to see that, especially like you said, the colorful books. They pop out. They definitely want to check that out. So.
Yeah,
I appreciate huge. Everything you do as well. Like, that's awesome.
I appreciate the support. Yeah, I mean, you were a big part of that too, Matt. So I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, no, you've really supported our mission and me for as long as I can. I mean, sixth grade is pretty much my memory. So I'm, you know, beating the head a little bit too much.
I think, do you guys remember? I shaved my head with when you and Cameron. I was like, I'm gonna shave my head too. And I was like, yeah, we got to do it. We got to do it for the boys.
But did you go bald?
No, I don't know.
But did you go bald? Oh, gosh. Clearly, books mean a lot to you.
Definitely.
And we heard that from you in the beginning of this podcast. It echoes with your nonprofit. But how would you verbalize literature?
Literature, as far as like... Shakespeare?
In your life. No, just in your life.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Like literature in my life. Yeah. I would say that, and I kind of touched this on the very beginning, books are so important, and I think more important than any other form of media or any other form of information that you're taking in, because generally, if the author is a stand-up author, they're going to really try and flesh out their ideas, because they're going to, if they want to, you know, tell you about something, they're going to know that obviously it's a new idea or you're going to have questions. And so they're going to try and, you know, answer each and every question that might come to your head. And they're going to really flesh out their idea on paper so that you can take it all in and really consider it.
Yep.
And so I think that the value of books in real life is anytime you want to consider a new idea, read a book about it from a well-respected author, and that's the most wholehearted attempt you can do to keep an open mind, because if that book doesn't convince you and it's from, like I said, a stand-up author, and they, you know, they know what they're talking about, they're a, you know, a main proponent of this idea or whatever it may be, then you can wholeheartedly say that, hey, I tried, I listened, I heard out the pros and cons of this idea, and I don't like the idea.
Yeah.
And you can know why you don't like the idea.
Yep.
You know, you can see where you disagree with that idea. And then you can even, you know, read the books on the other side or a different perspective, right? You could write your own book. You could, you know, defend your own ideas. But that's, I think, that the most, you know, analytical and proper way to discuss ideas and disseminate ideas. That's, I think, the most important thing
in the way that it translates to real life.
I think books are really unique in the fact that they can guide your ideas.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I use books for like to pick a theme or a topic. Mm-hmm. So I'll just read a fictional book because I don't really like to read fiction, mm-hmm. but I use it to kind of dive into different worlds. And then with those worlds, like say, so I'm reading a book right now and it's about a guy that I thought he was going to be like, it's a Western novel. Mm-hmm. It takes place in 1875. I didn't read the year when I first bought the book. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was going to be about a trek out west. And since we're heading out west, I was like, oh, this will be interesting to read.
Yeah.
And it was literally, it's about paleontology. And I had no idea. Like, yeah. I read some stuff. But what's interesting about it is now I want to learn. I've always been interested in Native Americans, but I want to actually go get a book now about the history of Native Americans in certain regions because now I've read about them.
That's huge.
So I use it as a brainstorming thing. But you talked about writing your own books,
mm-hmm.
and you're doing just that with two, right?
Yeah,
two
of them. So right now I'm co-authoring a book. It's part of not kind of like an anthology. It's like a multiple kind of short, you know, pages from different authors. So I'm co-authoring a book in Turkish. So that's in the works. That's probably going to come out in a couple months. And then I'm also writing a book myself about kind of basically kind of the stuff that I talked about right here where, you know, unfortunately, the Messiah is not coming, guys. You know, we can't look to someone else to fix the problems that we're having every day.
Yep.
And we have either two options. We can either keep waiting for someone else to come and fix it, for dad to come and fix our car, right? Or we can say, guess it's up to us and, you know, roll up our sleeves because that's the only way that we're going to fix whatever problem that we see is happening. If you think that there's no problems, that's fine. You know, you don't have to do anything.
Keep chilling.
Just keep chilling, exactly. But a lot of people, a lot of our generation think that there's a lot of improvements that we can make. And nobody's going to make those improvements except for you, right? And so that's basically what that's about and what we can do as young citizens, you know, and the effect that we can have. Because at the end of the day, it's really not about, you know, different countries. It's about this idea of globalization, whether you like it or not, it's happening. And it's getting to a point where we're all one eventually. And the human race is eventually unifying. I mean, historically, right? Even if we look back, there's no denying that we went from small tribes to eventually nation states and bigger and bigger communities and tribes and countries and, you know, religions and you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So you're ready for the North American country.
Not the North American country. I'm talking about a global human race.
Sure. Yeah, I got you.
That
defends against aliens.
That defends against aliens, but more importantly, you know, can stand up for itself. More importantly, can stand up for the people that make up its body.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
What's the process like to writing a book or wanting to publish one?
Well, actually, just like we were talking about, I went on YouTube and
there you go.
So the one that I'm writing myself, so I basically, there's an app called Ulysses. I don't know if people know about it, but not to like name drop or anything, but basically just downloaded that and it helps you keep track of all the pages. And so I'm writing it on there. And then as far as, you know, finding a publisher, I'm going to try to find a publisher. If I don't find a publisher, there's so many ways to self-publish. There's so many ways to literally put it up on Amazon. I'm probably going to put it up for free because it's not about making money about it. It's about, I really think that, you know, a lot of people need to be given a little bit of hope.
Yeah.
I see a big part of our generation finding themselves hopeless and kind of just depressed. Like I said, you open the news and everyone's fighting and yelling and nobody's working towards a concrete solution.
Right.
And so, you know, it's basically what the book's about. And the idea is to just disseminate the idea.
Yeah.
It's not about to make money or anything. And in the book that I'm co-authoring in Turkish is actually going to kids that are orphan kids.
Okay. So there's no proceeds there either.
That's awesome.
So,
yeah. That's awesome. If you can't find a publisher, I'll hand scribe your book.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Help with that.
just to say I was a part of it. You know, I can just be like, you know, actually, you don't want me writing anything. And they can attest to that.
You can't read anything.
You don't want me writing anything. I can. I mean, I know what I'm saying or what I mean to say. It's like hieroglyphics, but
my handwriting's not that bad, not that good either.
You're a dentist.
He's not a dentist.
Okay, he works in a.
Excuse me,
my bad.
Next.
I tried to make a joke. It didn't work so well.
Do you have any tips for starting?
Tips for starting: just start, and it's don't wait for the opportunity. It never comes. There's never a time that things feel safe or right. It's all about literally getting up and just taking the first step. And once you fall for the first time, it's probably the biggest relief because you fall for the first time and you realize, hey, that didn't hurt so bad. Well, I hope it doesn't, right? unless you mess something up really, really big, don't blame me. But 99% of the time, if you try something and you fail, it's not going to be that bad. And once you fail for the first time, you're going to be like, hey, that wasn't that bad. So I don't know what I'm scared of to try.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So then you start trying things again and failure becomes kind of like this, you know, just kind of this side effect of success.
Yep. A lot of people that I've listened to stare failure right in its face, fall down 7 times, get up 8.
Yeah.
That's my boy Denzel.
Yeah.
Raw's out.
Yeah.
Peace.